Hello again, everybody. I'd like to introduce our moderator for today's program. Hello, hello. I'd like to introduce our moderator for today's program, Karen Greer. Karen has worked at WXIA 11 Alive since 1999. She currently co-anchors the morning newscast 11 Alive News Today. She's also a past president of the Atlanta Press Club. Please welcome Karen Greer.
Good morning. How are you this afternoon? You are in for a really great treat. Meredith, we've been together now for how many hours? Seems like a lifetime. So you are in for a treat today. Meredith Vieira continues to be one of the top journalists in our industry, leaving her stamp on three major networks, CBS, ABC, and of course now NBC. With her own personality and style, she's the co-anchor of the top morning show in America. At the same time, Meredith is a mother of three and constantly balances work and life. Over the years, Meredith has been part of many popular shows such as 60 Minutes, The View, and right now also on 11 Alive. Who wants to be a millionaire? Please join me in welcoming Ms. Meredith Vieira.
Thank you very much. We're going to do Q&A in a second, but I just wanted to thank you all for inviting me here to talk to you. I noticed that the Gaffey Group was sponsoring this. It should be the Guppy Group, considering where I was today at the aquarium. I've had just a great time in this city. I just wish that I could spend time seeing it. You know, I know that the Four Seasons has a lovely room where I spent last night having room service. I look forward to answering your questions. I'm not somebody that's big on making speeches, which is one of the reasons why I went into journalism. I love to ask the questions. I'm curious about what other people do and never have taken myself that seriously, never feel I have much to say. But at 54, I've lived a long time, so I have some wisdom in the business. I keep moving from network to network, and that's not because I've lost the jobs, as some people think. I've just had opportunities come to me or have, in more recent years, having had children, tried to carve out a career that fits in my family, because if you know anything about me, that is my MO. I mean, that's the most important thing in my life, and at the end of the day, truly the only thing that matters to me. I love my work, and I'm very proud of what I do, but without my family, there'd be nothing. So with that said, although they are getting on my nerves recently, they're all teenagers, but that's a whole other story. Anyway, thank you so much for inviting me out here, and I'll try to answer your questions.
Great, Meredith. First one being, since you mentioned moving, different careers, different
yes.
jobs, started as an investigative reporter. Talk a little bit about what's been your favorite professional role thus far.
You know what, and I'm not trying to evade the question, although I'm pretty good at that. I haven't had a favorite role. I've tried to, as I said before, find the right job at the right time for me. I have to say that 60 Minutes was always my dream job when I got into the business. Never was particularly interested in being an anchor, but saw that show as the pinnacle. If you're going to be a reporter, to me, that was the best show you could be on. And then when I got there, had my son Ben was 6 months old at the time. He's now a freshman in college. But I soon realized, and relatively quickly, that it was very, very hard to juggle both of those successfully. I would be crying when I was out in the field, because at 60 Minutes you travel extensively. In fact, Morley Safer, when I left, said, you know, my wife Jane wished that I had done what you did. I gave up my family for this job. And, you know, though you make decisions, and I'm not saying that one's right and one isn't, but I realized pretty quickly that I was stressed and pulled in both directions in that particular job. That gave way after my son Gabriel was born. And then I moved into a whole different area of documentary work, which I loved, worked at the time. And then when The View came along, I thought, well, that might be a fun thing to do, because I didn't want to travel anymore and I was a reporter. And as my husband said, how can you report if you're not going to leave the house? So that guy's smart, you know? And so The View was just, you go in, you chat, and then you go home. I never thought I'd like it. I loved it. And then 9 years into it, really, one of the main reasons why I took the Today Show, besides the fact that it is the Today Show, was that my kids were sick of me talking about them on The View. you know, hot topics. What do you do, Meredith? Well, I'm a mom, and, you know, Lily, you know, has a boyfriend. And then I'd hear from Lily that night, you said I had a boyfriend? So that killed that show. That one was dead. And I was lucky that today came along when it did and actually fit beautifully into my life right now. And Millionaire is just the icing on the cake. I absolutely adore doing that show. People say to me, why would you ever want to do a game show? And my answer is, why not? You meet wonderful people. Many, I know all their backstories, and so many of them need the money for very serious, serious reasons. They might have a family member who's sick, or they've got a mortgage they can't pay, or they've got somebody that they want to say thank you to, and they want to help out. And then there are the professional game players, too, but it's one of those shows where you leave happy every time you do it, and you're giving away money that isn't yours, so it's perfect.
Now, you actually turned down jobs, network jobs, before. Talk about why you did that.
I did. Well, 5 years before the Today Show, CBS came to me, and Andrew Hayward was the executive producer at the time. Or, no, actually, he was president of news. He'd be really upset if I didn't get that right. And we go back a long way to when I was in local news at CBS. It's my first job in New York City was at Channel 2 at CBS. And I thought about it at the time, and there was a big push. You know, they dangled a lot of financial incentives and all of that. But I knew that the timing wasn't right, and it wasn't the right fit for me. And I've always sort of, I don't know, everybody has their own way of figuring out whether a job is right or not. And me, it's a gut thing. If I get that, you never get that in your stomach. When I get that, I know it's the wrong thing to do. And I didn't get that with the Today Show. Now I have it, but I didn't have it then. No, I don't.
A question from Nick from Edelman. Who's your producer, and how do you work together on the segments that interest you? How much time and planning process do you have with your producer?
It varies dramatically, and I'm still, believe it or not, a year into the job trying to get my feet wet. There's so many things when you walk into a show like the Today Show. First, I was coming in following Katie Couric, so that was a big deal in and of itself, and my goal was just to fit in. You know, to fit into this group and be a team player, because I think there's strength in teams, and I have always believed that. I look at like Seinfeld. It worked because it was a team. You break it up, it fails. So I just wanted to be part of this group and have gotten to know the producers slowly. I think when you come in, two people are not, and don't take this the wrong way, they're a little bit wary. You know, who is she? What is she about? What are her interests? So you have to, it's a bit of a dance that you learn to do. And now I feel like I got all the steps down. I'm feeling really good about it and having a little more say in the kinds of stories that I can do. I'm very interested, for obvious reasons. My husband has MS. I'm very interested in chronic illness and was able to do a series on that. Simply because I went to my executive producer, Jim Bell, and I said, I care about this. And I think when you have millions upon millions of people in this country dealing with chronic illness, I bet other people will care. Even though it can be a downer, there's a lot of positive that can come out of that series, and he was great. So I'm realizing now that I actually have a little weight around there. You don't really, you know, I think like, oh man, cool. You care what I think?
Well, you actually brought up a question that I was thinking about, talking about Richard, Emmy award-winning producer as
yes,
well.
Yes, he is.
MS and cancer. You've also dealt with cancer with him. How has that changed you as a person and your family?
Yeah, he had two bouts, actually, of colon cancer, which is, like, not fair when you have MS. I think it's made us a much stronger family, to be honest with you. If you knew Richard, he's got a fantastic sense of humor, very sarcastic, but great sense of humor, and I think that has helped us as a family. I mean, everybody has their struggles. I think that has been what has kept us together, and as hard as it can be on a family, I think we have extremely empathetic children for having a dad who has had struggles. And they've seen that, and I think they're incredibly proud of him and the strength of character that he displays every day. I mean, there are days where he has a lot of trouble getting out of bed, and there are days when a good-looking woman is, like, from me to that pole, and he spots her in a second, and he's legally blind, which I don't get. You know, sometimes I think, this MS is such an act, you know? Stop it! Put that cane down! But then I know he's got it. But, you know, he's just a great guy, and that's how we get through it. And I think our family, everybody has something. Everybody has something, and that just happens to be our something. And inevitably, the next person you meet, you know, you have your own bag of issues or worries, and you probably in the end wouldn't trade them with anybody else. So we do okay. He just wrote a second book, and I'm selling it out of the back of my minivan, if you're interested.
And the name of it
Strong
is?
Strong at the Broken Places, and it's great. It just came out, and it's really a profile of five people dealing with illness And one of them is from this area, actually,
right,
dealing with mental illness. And he was going to be speaking. Wow, Richard, I forgot. He's going to be speaking at the, is it the Carter?
Yes, Carter Library, Center.
Yes, Center here in April with Larry, who Larry has dealt with mental illness his whole life. And he's one of the people profiled in Richard's book. And Rosalind Carter read the book and wrote a little blurb about it. And so they're all going to be here.
Yeah, mental
so
illness is...
treat him nice. And if you're good looking, he will notice.
Mental illness is definitely a big, big
Absolutely.
Point for the Carter Center and Mr. and Mrs. Carter. Alyssa from Harry Norman wants to know your most and least favorite interview subjects.
Oh, who wanted to know that?
Alyssa?
Alyssa is a troublemaker. I can't say my least favorite. I can tell you it was an actor that I adored, and when I finally met him, he was just such a conceited jerk. But you know what I decided afterwards, because I'm trying to be gracious in my older years. I think what happened was he was on the dog and pony thing, you know, promoting a movie, and probably by the time he got to me, sick and tired of it. And I know what that feels like, but that, it made me realize I never will put people up on pedestals again. It's just a foolish thing to do. And it wasn't fair to that guy either, you know, because we're all just human beings. And my most favorite interviews are always so-called ordinary people who've been put in extraordinary situations. I much prefer that to politicians, nothing against them, but or you know, people of celebrity, because they tend to be programmed because they're so worried and careful about what they say, you know, because words can be very dangerous and they can end up back in print. And people who are just out there trying to do the right thing and get through another day and accomplish something extraordinary in their life, to me, are the most fascinating.
Jen from Pink Magazine, what's your best advice for juggling work, family, and your busy life?
Well, I said to somebody else, don't have glass balls, because you'll drop them and they'll break, you know. Not the other kind. I mean, the silence that came over the room. My gosh. Oh, man. I don't have any. I don't have. See, this is why I'm in trouble in live television. I don't have any great advice for juggling, except, you know, to just appreciate that you're human and some days will be better than others, and you know, ask people for their forgiveness. I remember forgetting my son. It was Colonial Day at his school and in fourth grade, and he's the only one who didn't show up in a costume. Okay. Man. Oh, man. You want me to just break down again? Oh, well, this must be nice Atlanta. Southern hospitality. It was bad. It was really bad. And I suffered through that one for a long time. And I just kind of said to Gaby, I'm really sorry. And he's had a few years of therapy. He's much better. Much better. So, but fortunately, there aren't too many of those. But we are, I mean, it, you know, we've all had something like that or a close second to that. And you just hope that you have fewer rather than more.
Good point. And a couple are just the same questions. If you could tell our next president one thing, what would it be? From John.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, help. Just help us all. I don't know. I wouldn't want to be in that position. I really wouldn't. There are so many struggles that we all face, but I just hope that whoever gets in there means what they say. You know, I'm so frustrated through years, and I try not to be a cynic, and I'm not particularly, but, you know, if you've been around and you hear the same old, same old, same old, it can be very frustrating. So I want to believe that this batch is the right group. I have one in particular that I like, but...
You have a politician in your family, don't you? Your brother's in politics? Is somebody in your family in politics, per se? No,
my son wants to be president.
that works.
My son Ben, who went out on the road with me, actually with both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, made it clear to both of them.
Oh, wow.
I was feeling like, Ben, you could be a little more deferential, you know, but he's very interested. And you know what? I think that's great when I see young people, particularly in this election year, you see so many young people coming out. It is wonderful to hear someone my son's age excited about the process and believing that they can make a difference and that this world can be a better place. I think that is great, and that's something to nurture because they're inheriting it.
That's right. Mentor, have you had a mentor, someone who really helped guide your career?
Yeah, I've had a few. It's, you know, it's very funny. I graduated from Tufts University in 1975, and it was around the time then there were quotas for women, people of color. I came in, I kept getting jobs because I was a woman, and they would list me as Hispanic, even though I'm actually Portuguese, but they put it as Hispanic. And I found I would get jobs and then nobody would help you. And it was almost, there was almost a resentment. And I now, in with some distance, understand. I think people, there were people who felt, why, you're only hiring her because it's a her. And so I came in with them having a chip on their shoulder, and then I would develop a chip on my shoulder. So it was very hard in terms of finding real mentors then. But I had some along the way at CBS who were really wonderful. Howard Stringer in particular. So Howard Stringer, who's now the muckety muck at Sony. I can't even keep track of him anymore. But he was my executive producer at CBS Evening News, and he used to be very, very tough on me with every script. We used to type our scripts and then read them over the phone, and they'd type them again in New York. And I was, you know, my typing was like, boom, boom. But I was a really good writer. And that's my number one word of advice to journalists out there, budding journalists, learn how to write. And Howard would really go over my scripts, and he was very, very hard on me and very supportive as well. So I owe him a tremendous, tremendous amount. Unfortunately, when I was coming up, there were very few women, and they pitted women against each other. And it was hard to find a woman who would support another woman, which was a sad state of affairs, truly.
Absolutely. What's your best advice, or what's the best advice you've ever received?
Oh, it was when I was at Channel 10 News in Providence, Rhode Island. It was my first television job. And the news director there on a Friday brought me in, and he said, I don't think you have what it takes. We're going to let you go. And I grew up in East Providence, and I went home to my parents' house, and I'm in my bedroom, which hadn't been touched. As my husband says, it's like a museum setting. My mother never took anything out of the rooms. And I was lying on the bed crying hysterically, and my dad, this great salt-of-the-earth guy, doctor, GP, general practitioner, came in, and he said, what's the matter? And I told him, and he said, well, do you think you have what it takes? And I said, yeah. He said, then why do you care what anybody else says? Your whole life you're going to have people tell you don't have what it takes. And, I always get, like, crying. And, I said, okay. And so that Monday I went in to the news store. I think I scared the hell out of him because I went into his office and said, I have what it takes. I don't care. I'm going to make it in this business. And he said, you have your job back. And I got the job back, and
wow.
About 6 months later, a talent scout who was traveling around the country, at least he said he saw me in a motel. I think he meant on the television. And he asked for a tape, audition tape. I didn't even have one. We quickly made one up. The director at Channel 10 was a friend of mine. He put it together fast, and a week later, Channel 10 News in New York called and said, we'd like to see you, and I was hired by New York. That was just a fluky thing.
That's awesome.
Where they immediately listed me as Hispanic. So, but what the heck?
You know, we always go through as women these hair issue things. Give us your great hair story.
Oh, I do. If you ever really feel like your hair sucks, when I got hired by, I was going from Channel 2 to the evening to CBS News, and I had turned them down once, and they said, we'll never come back. And I said, well, I'm not ready. If I come when I'm not ready, I'm not going to hold on to this job anyhow. So a year later, sure enough, I don't know why, but lightning struck twice. And this guy, John Lane, who was a vice president then, said, we'd like to hire you. And I said, okay. I was taking a month off, and I have bone straight hair. So I decided to get a perm. And it didn't come out very well. It just wasn't curly enough. So don't ever do this. You don't get a perm on top of a perm. I didn't know that. I went back and they said, well, we'll perm it again. They permed it again, and my hair started falling out in massive clumps. And you have to understand, like, I had long, beautiful hair, and I think that's not to say that people are sexist, but I think that was part, it was part of the package. You're on television. So I go into, I had my friend chop my hair off. It looked disgusting. And I went to CBS Evening News, report for duty that January, and I'm wearing a wool hat, and I'm not taking it off, you know? And I'm in the building, and about a week passes, and I'm assigned to the Northeast Bureau, which is where I want to be. I want to be in New York, boyfriend's in New York. And about a week into this, John Lane comes by, and I think they're starting to think, what's the matter with her? Is she demented? He says, can you take off the hat? And I mean, they can tell he's peeved a little. So I take off the hat. He doesn't say anything. You know, he's just sort of looking. And I kid you not, that was like on a Tuesday. That Friday, Van Gordon Sauter, who was the president of CBS News at the time, called me up, and he said, you know what? We think you'd be good in Chicago. And I left for Chicago the next day, and I was reporting outdoors from Chicago that whole winter with my hat on. But you know, what was bizarre, and they didn't plan on this, the little devils, that was right when the economy was going south, and there were constantly stories out of the Rust Belt and the Farm Belt about the economy, and it was me that was covering them, so I was on constantly. By that spring, I was a pretty big name at CBS, so when you get a bad perm, life isn't over. There you go. It's true. But they were glad when my hair grew back, too. Weren't they?
Maria's a reporter from the AJC. Much has been said about the changes in the news industry. What are the challenges for serious news organizations?
I think there are a lot of challenges. I think there's been a real dumbing down of the news. We talk about this all the time on Today, and you know, you're often find that you're part of the problem. I think this came up more recently with the Britney Spears, not this latest, but just that whole thing about celebrity and journalism and becoming sort of another tabloid show when you're not supposed to be, and yet you see the ratings spike. So you're constantly fighting that notion of, do you give the people what you think they want? Are you so consumed by those numbers, which, because ratings mean money coming in, or do you deliver what you should, which is the news that people need to know? And I think we all have struggled with it. I just know that when we did something called Today's 101 on the Shia and the Sunni, and do we really want to do this? And I do a blog, and I'd put it out on the blog, what do you want to know? And people said, we want to understand what's going on in Iraq, and we did that. We got a tremendous response. It was just basic stuff, but it was obvious that people are hungry for news, and they're hungry for content. So I think we're trying to do the best we can, but we're constantly fighting against that tabloid take on things. And I think it's one of the hardest struggles that we have right now, to be honest with you. And also because news is 24 hours, people need to fill up time. And it's easy to fill it up with sensational news because it's simple. It is just simple to do. I had a gentleman stop me today and say, please give us more international news. We need to understand this world in which we live. It's very small, and we are so dependent on each other. And if we don't, I mean, the truth is, if you live in this country, how many other countries can you even identify on a map? It's something that kids don't even learn anymore. So I feel like I'm part of the problem, but I also want to be part of the solution.
Got a couple of young people.
There's that gentleman, right? Aren't you the one? Yes, right there. See, I listen to you. Now I just have to act on it.
A couple of young people, one a graduate of UGA, one from Emory, one's a prosecutor, working for the public broadcasting station, wanted to get into anchoring. What would your advice be for them?
Oh, boy, I think it's be a good reporter, to be honest with you. I think that's the most important thing you can do is, in order to sit there at the anchor desk, I think you have to have gone out in the field and experienced what it's like to go and talk to people and cover stories. I think that's very important to do. It used to be, back when my hair was falling out and whatever, the anchors were the people that had earned that spot through years of reporting. It has, I don't know how true this is, but supposedly more and more now, they'll pick an anchor based on the way they might look or whatever it is. And I think that's a dangerous thing. You need to have experience and go out and get it. And don't be afraid to go to a small market. It's a great place to learn, actually, because you get to do more. Providence is where I started, which wasn't that small, but I didn't carry the camera, but I edited, I produced, I wrote, and I reported, and I thought that was a great experience to have. But that would be my best advice.
Besides Richard's book, what's your favorite book right now? What are you reading?
It's good luck reading anything, to be honest with you. I'm overwhelmed with just keeping up with the newspapers and all of that. I mean, when I have a particular guest, then I might read their book at any given moment and trying to just stay on top of the news. It's very hard. I pick up books and I read the first five pages, fall asleep, and the next night I have to read the first five pages again. So I'll cop to that.
Dory wants to know, after reporting on a tragic or difficult story, how do you process that? How do you let it go and move on with your life?
I don't know that you ever totally let it go. The last one that I did, or the one that stands out the most right now in my mind, is Virginia Tech. And I think that the best way to do that as a reporter is to reflect upon the difference you might have made in terms of the people who watch the coverage and helping them better understand it, and also the people that you are covering. When I was at Virginia Tech, there was a candlelight ceremony, and I went simply to watch, not to cover it. And I had so many kids come up to me and hug me and just say, can we just hold you for a minute? They knew me from the Today Show and from my years on television, and I reminded them of their mom, and they wanted to be with their mom. And that really helped me get through Virginia Tech, just that feeling that maybe in a tiny little way I had helped someone. You're not supposed to become part of the story, but that's what we're trying to do, is just help each other. So
let's talk about Beijing, NBC Olympics. When are you going to start reporting from there?
I don't know. They haven't figured it out yet when we're going to leave. Megan may know better than I do, but I'm not sure. Yeah, we'll be going before it starts. I'm just scared they're going to make me do something stupid because, you know, these people on the Today Show are nuts. They all like to jump, and Ann's always jumping out of a plane, off a building, you know, I like to have a lunch. To me, that's like fun. But I know we'll probably do something like that. I believe that Matt is going to be involved in the opening ceremonies, which is something Katie had done. Even that's not set in stone yet. I think historically or traditionally they leave on a Friday and then they hit the ground that Monday. We're doing the Today Show from there because it's Beijing and it's so far away. I don't know if they'll pull us off the show a little bit earlier to get there. I'm not sure what the situation is at this point. I did get to go in June, last June, a year out, or last August, I'm sorry, because it's 8-8-08. And it was, I think it's going to be really, really fascinating to be there. It's tremendous pollution, which supposedly they're going to deal with, and logistically it's tricky because it's east meets west, and on every level there are differences, but I think that'll make it very, very interesting. And also NBC's going to be walking a fine line because on the one hand we're guests and we're trying to cover sports. On the other hand, there are a lot of questions about China and human rights and their exports and all of those things and how we handle it without also getting thrown out of the country, you know, while we're trying to cover it. I can't wait to see that one, you know.
You said this is your dream job. Any other dream job that you've...
I did a piece on pediatric clowning for the Today Show. Quite a few months probably. I lose track of time. It's done by, the Big Apple Circus. It's one of their outreach programs.
Yeah.
They are? Oh, they're great. Go see them. They're great. Their outreach programs are so terrific. And they allowed me, they don't normally do this, but they allowed me to be a pediatric clown. And what you do is you go into, most of the children are very, very ill. And with their blessing, if the kid wants you to go in the room, you do. And you just spend a few minutes allowing them to call the shots. You know, when in a hospital, you don't have much say over anything. And also to be kids. And you allow their parents an opportunity to laugh. And I loved that so much. And they've said if I wanted to do that, I could. So I think I would, that's the kind of thing I would love to do, because it was just, again, it's sort of from a different way from the Millionaire Show, but it's just one of those things where you feel so good at the end of the day. And I love kids. So, and mine are all grown, so why not have some more?
What's your best advice for your kids? What do you tell them that you hope they'll hold on to?
I just want them to be true to themselves. Sort of what my dad said to me, believe in yourself. Maintain your sense of humor, be kind to other people, and enjoy your life. And at the end of the day, what you do doesn't matter. It's who you are. And I think we are lucky that we have good kids. And we're talking at the table here. For us, so much of it has been They happen to have great friends, and if you can watch your kid, and I watch their friends like a hawk, you know, and they're just, one time, I remember, this is so weird, but I came home early for lunch, and we were living at that time close to the school, because our home was being renovated, and so we had moved to a home near the school. I came home, and one of Ben's friends was playing classical music in the living room, and I went, yes, this is a nerd. This is great. This is great. So, you know, it's just finding great friends who will support each other, because that's who's going to be with them, you know, and then enjoying it.
As a high-profile career woman, what are your thoughts about how Hillary Clinton's gender is portrayed in the media? She's been vilified quite a bit, and her gender often comes up, particularly the crying episodes that have been talked about.
I think she has been vilified, you know, but it is a double-edged sword, because after one of those first debates, when she talked about the boys, you know, the boys ganging up on her, I don't think that was probably the best argument that could have been made at the time. But yeah, I think gender and race, whether we like it or not, have been inserted into this campaign. I think both candidates are now making an effort to step away from that as much as possible. But it's hard being the first woman doing anything. And I think, you know, it's funny. When I had the opportunity to meet her one-on-one, what struck me the most about Hillary Clinton is she's incredibly engaging. She's incredibly nice. She's very, very smart. And why that doesn't seem to translate is, to me, what is so interesting, because if you ever get the opportunity one-on-one, and, you know, to a certain extent, you say, sure, she's going to be nice to you. You're a reporter. She wants you to do a good story. But it was more than that. I watched her with other people, and she's very good. But something happens, you know, when she's in a crowd, and I don't know what that is. If something else takes over, I'm wiser minds will be able to answer that. But I do think it is tough to be a woman, but I think she does a great job representing our gender, and it's thrilling to see a woman run for president. In my lifetime, I think it's fantastic.
Meredith Vieira has been great. If you want to see that blog she's been talking about and her and those...
You're waiters, in it, by the way, tomorrow. So
she needs to get out of town, so let's give her a round of applause. Really? Thank you so much.
Thank you all. Thank you so much for your hospitality.
Thanks, everybody. That concludes our program.